Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
This is Anne Magnuson, Admiral Clancy on Star Trek Picard, and you've got the sheer fucking hubris to listen to the greatest discovery!
Captain! Captain!
Report.
Signatures detected!
Shields up!
Signatures detected!
Red alert!
Context Starfleet Command!
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command!
Delay that order!
Context Starfleet Command!
This is the captain!
Context Starfleet Command!
Get out of my chair! Chair!
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons?
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery, a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
This is a strange record, Adam. You're recording not from your house, but from John Roderick's house.
Right. Yeah. Is that why I sound so much more authoritative? I'm ready to bullshit you now, Ben.
Oh, wow. Boy, I can't wait.
Yeah.
Your house is all packed up.
It's been a real couple of weeks, and it's all coming to a point, like just about now, actually, is when everything is happening. All of these months are ending in the next hour or so. It's great timing by us.
This is how great podcasts are made, when one of the hosts is at the apex of his stress.
Yeah. Yeah, you're going to get my best work today, I'm sure of it. I think it's where great comedy comes from, right? Trauma? That's what everyone says.
I mean, it's tragedy plus time.
Yeah. No one ever says trauma plus time.
No. It occurs to me that that's what this series is actually kind of about. Like,
oh, yeah.
We were criticized for not spending much time on the conversation between Seven of Nine and Picard about how much it sucks to have been a B and now be an XB.
That was like the main takeaway of that episode for me. And I thought I said so.
This episode is about like deepening that and...
Absolutely.
And the trauma plus timeness of basically every character in in the series is on full display in this episode.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I think that's probably a great segue into episode, Ben. I wasn't imagining that that my life would apply so neatly to what's going on here in in Star Trek Picard Season 1, Episode 6, The Impossible Box.
Yeah, and perfectly mapping onto your life, the opening is of kind of a spookily empty house with rain battering the window. Could be Seattle for all we know.
Yeah, not today. It's really glorious today. The city is giving me its best before I break up with it.
Giving you a sweet kiss goodbye.
I want to throw something out there to you and to anyone else within the sound of my voice. Do you think they're using alternate takes for the last time on package? Kind of feel like they are. Like these angles look different. The dialogue's the same, but I haven't A-B'd them. I feel like they're giving us different looks here, and I like it. I like it if it's true.
Wow. That's really fucking with the reality if it's true.
Maybe intentionally. It's fun. But if I'm not right, what does that mean about me and my powers of observation? I don't know.
It means you're 80% brain right now, you know?
I really am. 80% is more than most people's 60%. That's what I think.
I concur. I totally agree with that. I think most people, 60% is what your 80% is.
Soji is having dreams about being young, and like most young people, she's having a hard time sleeping, and she wants to seek out her daddy because she can't. So she pushes open his office door. He works from home, I guess. That's one thing we know about him, about Bruce Maddox. And I don't know if you have this rule at your home office, Ben, but no one is allowed into the home studio. I'm a Bruce Maddox that way.
Yeah, I wish I was. I have my home studio is also the guest bedroom.
Yeah.
Which really cramps my style. Like, oh yeah, you're gonna see my giant Rubbermaid tub full of Star Trek toys people have mailed us. Yeah. And like a extremely thick pile of tour posters from 2 years ago that we didn't sell.
There's no shame in that game.
I want to sell out our tour posters.
I thought for sure Soji would do that thing that everyone does in a dream from time to time, is like walk into a bathroom and start peeing, and then, oh no.
You wake up and it's not actually a bathroom.
Right. That is not what happens. Instead, her dad yells at her, and then she wakes up in Narek's bed.
Is it Narek's bed or her bed? I guess it is Narek's bed because it's got all the plants around, right?
Yeah. He's got those very expensive herb gardens.
You're going to get a harvest 2 to 4 weeks early by starting your plants inside.
Narek's involved in the loyalty program at Williams-Sonoma. So
right.
He realized he could juke the system by buying six at once.
No one has the Williams-Sonoma credit card except for Narek. He saw the value in that.
Yeah.
The scene where Narek tends to Soji made me think a lot about that parachute scene in Pearl Harbor, the improvised softbox that you can make in a scene like this. In Pearl Harbor, yeah. They use parachutes and the light was coming in and it softens everything up real nice. Under this sheet in bed, you get that same effect. It's very, very flattering.
Yeah, they look great.
Yeah.
These two lovebirds. He's sort of lovebirding her, but also plying her for information about the dream. Like, would you say that it was like a dream that your mind made up at random or based on a real memory? And she's like, weird question. don't know.
What would you say your heart rate was at around this time in approximate beats per minute? I'm just going to put this blood pressure cuff on you.
Yeah. He's like, I know, but I want you to tell me what you think it was.
Right. I don't think this would fly in most relationships. This amount of interrogation. It's suspicious at all times, but it's growing in suspicion for Soji as more and more of these scenes happen.
You know, I thought a lot about this, and like, she is very suspicious of him in many scenes leading up to this episode, but I think the shiftiness and it's always a game of chess with themness of Romulans maybe makes her slightly more open to
that's a great call. It's just Narek being Narek.
If he was a Klingon, she would expect him to be like singing Melota to her.
Yeah.
But because it's a Romulan, he's like asking her extremely probing questions and not revealing his real name.
Rom's gonna Rom.
Roms are gonna Rom.
Yeah.
I just, you know, like, I want to find a Romulan that I can change. I want a Project Romulan.
Yeah. Good luck with that. They don't seem like fixer-uppers, Ben.
They seem pretty sure of themselves.
They seem like the type of people that has a very strong city council idea of not changing anything about them.
Yeah. Romulans are in the streets protesting, protected by lanes.
Yeah.
This scene ends with a little moment of Soji reflecting on a picture of her mom and her sister as younger girls. And it's on a table with some like, I don't know, some chalks or some paints or something. And then some of those like wooden artist models, like the model of the hand and the model of the body that you can put into pose.
She raided the Michaels craft store on on the Borg cube. Every place has a Michaels. It doesn't matter how big or small your town is. And the same goes for the artifact.
Yeah. One thing that has been like greatly overstated about the Federation is that it's a utopia. It's just better than the present because they've outlawed Hobby Lobby. They've gone all Michaels.
Right. Yeah.
No need to apologize. Excuse me.
Now, the next scene in the episode is the scene I'll call the in-butt-out-butt scene.
Mm-hmm.
That is the scene where Agnes Girardi is talking to Picard about Bruce Maddox and how and why he died, lying to him, because we know that she did something to the biobed to cause his to cause him to die.
Those that didn't like the amount of gore in the last episode will not like this scene, because Dr. Girardi is wearing basically like that white rubber smock, and she is covered in Bruce Maddox blood. Like she's fucking Bill the Butcher.
Fear.
Having just done the post-mortem.
Yeah. In butts, Elnor, who, you know, wants to get in on this conversation. Elnor is got a very Data-like role in this show, I want to say. Like early TNG Data, where he doesn't understand the ways of the people he's on a spaceship with.
Yeah. He's less lame than Data, though. Data season 1 and 2 didn't seem that funny to me, but Elnor is very funny to me this season.
Yeah, and cool, because he can waste Tal Shiar's with abandon.
It's pretty clear from this scene that Dr. Girardi's evil, right? Because she's straight up lying to Picard about the circumstances of Bruce Maddox's death when Elnor arrives. She's forever changed.
Yeah, we talked earlier in the series about what she was maybe being set up for, because I felt like she had been given a full like call to adventure hero's arc beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm now seeing that that was misdirection and that she's really kind of a mystery. She's definitely not the protagonist, but I don't get the sense that she killed Bruce Maddox out of bloodlust, you know?
Yeah.
It seems like she is doing something that she doesn't feel personally capable of doing. You know, like she is clearly feeling ultra guilty about doing a murder.
Yeah, I mean, if she was truly evil, I think she'd be colder about this. I think you're probably right about that.
Yeah, and that's like where Elnor is like a fun character to introduce to the scene when he inbutts. He's like, yeah, you seem like you feel real bad about something and you want to not be feeling that right now. And she's like, fuck off.
It leaves the possibility open of her character redemption too at the end.
Right.
It seems like she can fix this.
Yeah. If we find out that O has a metaphorical gun to her parents' heads or something like that.
This scene is really great. And I think the reason why is that Girardi does that thing where she describes someone else's story to Elnor, and Patrick Stewart's face and entire carriage changes completely when he hears his own story said back to him. And Picard is clearly pissed, like first contact pissed, when he starts thinking about all the things that he went through. And then he storms off to go smash something over in his ready room.
He's like, I must have some little ships around here somewhere.
No!
He compares the Borg to cancer. And, you know, like, we talked a lot when on Greatest Generation we were reviewing TNG. And, like, you know, there's one episode after he is XB'd that he has some cries in the mud with his brother. But it never seemed like he really, truly dealt with what happened to him, and it seems like that's what this is, you know, like, and especially in this episode when he's returning to the cube, it's like he is back to like full fight or flight about what he's about to experience.
I wonder if there's a way to enjoy this show just as completely if you were to stop watching TNG after the family episode in season 4. take the rest of your time off of Star Trek and pop back in for Star Trek Picard, because the tragedy of having a pre-serialization television show is that you and I, as we were watching TNG for the hit podcast, The Greatest Generation, we saw all of the meat on this story bone. Like, this should have, it was the moment that show could have pivoted to serialization, and for the rest of the series could have been about the grapple with this idea and this past. There's so much here.
Like, he literally does, like, Google image search of Borgs.
Yeah.
And is just scrolling through the top hits until he comes to his own image. And they've done this a couple of times, the, like, see-through screens of this show being being used to superimpose one face on another. But this is just his old Locutus face on him.
Production-wise, it's so much more elegant and fun to do it this way. Like, how many times have we seen any movie or television show where someone is doing computer research and you have to do shot reverse shot of face and screen? But you get it all in one here in a way that is great.
Like, the hollow screen is definitely being used for story purposes and not just a, hey, look at this neat techno thing that we can simulate with computer graphics.
That superimposition with Locutus's face over Picard's gives us the very rare Locutus eyes to theme, Ben. It's pretty heavy.
Indeed.
I mean, I know we were promised a Star Trek Picard series that had a lot to do with the Borg, but this is the moment where I'm starting to realize just how central the Borg are to this story, and it's... And at this moment in the episode, I got really excited.
Yeah. And for a guy that drinks as much as he does, Captain Rios's bod is really rocking.
I know, right? Good bod. Tight abs, V-shaped torso.
Should I be doing soccer ball workouts? Like, if I was out in a field, like, tapping a soccer ball back and forth between my feet, would I have six-pack abs?
Couple of things about that. I don't know that the soccer ball workout works that way with the core, though you may be using the ball in different ways. This ball, to me, looked a lot like a dismembered BB-8 body, though. I wonder if that was intentional, the way Rios is kicking this thing around. But yeah, like, you can put the ball up under your back and do, like, some crunches and stuff. I'm sure maybe he's doing that kind of workout. It's like one piece of gear. If you're going to work out barefoot, like, playing soccer on deck plating, your feet have got to be shredded, right?
Yeah. Rio seems like he's used to being, like, all alonesies on this ship, so that's an interesting function, is that he's, like, doing his workout just kind of out in the main part of the ship.
Yeah.
And Agnes Jurati is clearly, like, spent a night haunted and maybe got up early because of that. As a man who spends most of my nights haunted, I can really see myself in this moment.
She's haunted and horny. She interrupts the soccer ball workout, and she wants to work out some balls of her own.
If I've recently exercised, my wife wants nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
But this sweaty guy, he gets some action.
Rios is great. Rios is really, like, he's already top of the charts for me, like... He's top of the mountain on this show so far as characters go. He is really great in this scene. Like, from the start, he's been someone whose arm has been twisted into this mission, but I think he sincerely wants to listen to Jurati in this scene, who's clearly really struggling, and he's totally game to fuck her if that's what she wants him to do. It's funny, like, the way Jurati puts it, he's like, "Hey, babe, how are you feeling?" And she says four words.
Hollow, hopeless, lonely, afraid.
Now, Rios's dick can fix two of those things. And I think he knows that.
He can heal with his steel.
Yeah. Pretty fun.
She kind of backs off the inevitability of their fucking for the time being, but...
Yeah, we kind of cut from one horny scene to another, though, when we meet up with Rizzo and Narek, right?
Seriously. Rizzo is making fun of Narek for being a Rubik's Cube dork.
The way he puts it, though, is like it's a meditative device.
Yeah, it's a fidget spinner for Romulans.
Right.
The Tanjikran, he calls it. I have noticed in several close-ups of this thing when somebody, you know, turns one over, they never get it perfectly flush in the turn, and it's driving me fucking crazy. Like, I don't have like obsessive compulsive or anything, but just the fact that it's not locking in when I researched this, you can buy like off-brand Rubik's cubes that are actually like internally magnetized so that they just snap perfectly into alignment when you twist them. I wish they had based this prop off of one of those.
So your beef with the cube is that it looks like it should have some directionality that it doesn't have. Is that what you're saying?
No, it seems like it doesn't actually work. Like they got it so that it turns like 87 degrees and not 90 degrees when you twist one of these sides of it.
Well, I mean that's just like the Romulans, you know. Like you can only know them a maximum of 87%, right?
I guess yeah.
I don't know.
It's a fair point, Adam.
I don't know why I'm defending the cube so much.
They're talking about the relationship that Narek has with Soji, and Rizzo is basically at her limit. She's like, "All right, you're off the Soji fucking project, and I'm on the Soji torturing and plying for information project." And he's like, "Wait." Like, she's been telling me about her dreams, and like Rizzo's like, I don't care.
Right.
But he actually has a plan here, a pretty diabolical plan, to his credit.
Rizzo's really project oriented in a way that I admire. Like, she is not taking her eye off the ball at all.
Yeah. But things really start to happen fast in this episode.
Yeah, because Narek kind of talks it out in this way, right? Like he's defending his relationship with Soji, but in doing it, he unlocks a reason to keep working with her the way that he is, which is like her dream life may be the key to getting the information we need from her in a way that does not trigger her and set her off like the synthetic bomb that we know that she is.
Right.
And this talks Rizzo off of his dick, and they're like, fine, well, if you can do this by getting into her dream life, we might finally learn where her home world is.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, hey, Rizzo, remember those two entire Jat Vash death squads that bought it because of assuming that they could kill Daj? Let's try and avoid taking losses like that going forward.
Right. I mean, it's a total mystery how many people it would take to kill her. I mean, I guess it took one guy with an acid pill before, but I mean, that was after how many?
Yeah, and he just got lucky because he spit it on the gun.
Yeah, it doesn't look like this is a problem you can solve with extra bodies. Back in the La Serena, they're on their way through the old neutral zone on their way into Romulan space, and this is a problem because as soon as they cross that threshold, it becomes a legal problem for them, and also a military problem between the Federation and what remains of the Romulans.
Picard is no stranger to unilaterally starting a diplomatic incident with Romulans.
But his record lately has been shit. Like I get the sense from him, like they're approaching the cube and everyone's looking at Picard for a solution. And Picard is like 0-for-6 on ideas about doing things in this series. That's why he looks over at Elnor and he's like, oh yeah, let's co-op Malat this. Like, let's be utterly honest.
And that means like go in just saying like, hey, Picard wants to meet with the head of the reclamation project, personal friend, but he has these diplomatic papers. And everybody's like, how are you going to get diplomatic papers, Picard? Remember the CNC of Starfleet telling you to go, climb up a flagpole or whatever?
This is the moment where Rios weekend at Raffi's her into the chair and onto comms.
Yeah, Raffi has not taken the meeting with her son very well.
No.
She has really crawled back into the bottle.
Yeah, and into the snake too. She's smoking the snake weed. She's hitting the bottle. She's crossfading, Ben.
Ooh, yeah, you don't want to do that.
She comms up Emmy, which is an old pal of hers. She looks like she's got the four pips of a captain. And does a forgiveness over permission sort of ask. Like, she sort of begins with needing a thing and then makes it very clear that they are too far gone to turn back without the favor that she's asking Emmy. And Emmy finally capitulates with a 24-hour pass to the cube. So she helps, but not a lot.
Right.
And then she sort of hangs up on Raffi in a don't ever call me again kind of way. So it looks like she burned a friendship here for the mission.
After reading that novel, kind of the main thing about Raffi as a character is that she will set the personal aside for the mission.
Right.
Like, to an extent that is almost pathological.
Yeah. Back on the artifact, Soji and Narek keep talking about her dreamlike, and Narek is doing that thing that would be pretty irritating to most people, but Soji's curiosity is piqued by his constant needling her about all these conversations she has with her mom, and that they all last exactly 70 seconds. Narek knows this because he has the records of all the comm traffic into and out of the artifact.
Yeah. He really drops the veil here. Like, yeah, I'm spying on you.
Yeah, and it also lets us know as viewers just how much information he is able to get. Like, it's pretty clear that he knows everything that's happening on the cube. Is he, I don't want to use the rank, but I mean, he's the captain over there, right? Like, there's probably no one more powerful than he and Rizzo, right? Everyone has to answer to them, you think?
I don't know. I mean, it seems like people are afraid of him, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's sufficient.
That's like a do you know who I am kind of thing.
Right.
Like the Harvard student who takes too long on their test and then slips it into the middle of the pile. Like, everybody walking around on the cube could, like, theoretically be Tal Shiar or Jat Vash and do something horrible to you.
Yeah. I'm liking how more and more of that detail is being dosed out to us. It suggests it early on, but now it's really leaning into it, that he's a heavy.
That's impossible.
I can show you the logs.
There's a very tender scene between Rios and Raffi. A lot of R names on this show. Rios, Raffi, Rizzo.
Yep. What's
going on there? But yeah, she's really bottoming out, man. Schwasty. She's got half a bottle of Blade Runner scotch in her.
Yeah. This is a great scene for Rios, though, right? Like, again, when we met him, he was not a fan of his circumstances or this mission, but he definitely cares for Raffi, and he has some great bedside manner with her. He says some pretty profound things, too. Like, I really like this scene for him. It's good. But also, he's flawed enough to take the bottle with him, you know? Like, he's not a cure-all character for other people's problems. He's just as flawed as they are.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to keep, like, going back to TNG to draw comparisons, but, like, TNG, you know, like, almost every character over the course of the show you find out is, like, an orphan or had some, like, horrible shit happen to them in their childhood.
Right.
Or, you know, like, in one way or another, they are all, like, they all have pretty dark pasts and are pretty perfect despite it.
Yeah.
And this show is not drawing its characters in that way. It's not coming from the perspective that once we get an economic system that fails no one, is like everybody will be happy and perfect.
Yeah, everyone's conceived flawed and they stay flawed, for sure.
Right. Which is a very different standpoint on what Star Trek should be about than what TNG was. But I don't need it to be consistent, personally.
No, me neither. The seed that Narek planted earlier is now sprouting in the next scene. Soji FaceTimes her mom. She wants to break through the 70-second barrier with her. and she's willing to do whatever it takes to do it, including playing a game of five finger filet with herself.
Yeah, I think we can all relate to losing consciousness while on the phone with a parent.
Yeah, she can't break through the barrier, and she falls asleep in spite of it.
Talking to mom on the phone always induces drowsiness.
Yep.
What we know is that this is an AI that she's talking to.
Right.
And it seems like that AI could be inside of her, but it's actually been set up in such a way that, you know, like the Romulans are aware that she's like broadcasting signal with somebody off station. So like that part is pretty clever, but the fact that it's always exactly 70 seconds that it takes to knock her out
right.
seems like kind of an oversight from an OPSEC standpoint.
Yeah.
They're trying to find their homeworld, so presumably this transmission is coming from there, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you would think. I don't know quite how this works yet. I'm not sure if we're supposed to.
What does it mean, their homeworld? Because we know that the Maddox's lab got torched.
I mean, maybe there's something in the rubble. Or maybe the homeworld is different from the lab. Maybe Maddox went from working from home to like a WeWork type situation.
Oh, yeah. There's an office share in my neighborhood that's like for parents and kids.
That sounds terrible.
Every time I walk by that place, I'm like, that's probably like 2-3 years away from me, max.
Oh, God. I hope not. Back on the La Serena, they've arrived. They have engaged the Borg, Ben. And this is the moment in the episode where I think Sir Patrick Stewart really rises to his character. I think what he is dealing with in these scenes non-verbally, I mean, there is some verbalization of what he's going through, but the expressions that he throws, like his posture, how his posture changes, it is so painful for him to be back there. And it answers a question that you and I have had for a long time. Like, what could it possibly be like to face the worst fear and to have your mission be based aboard your worst fear, basically? Like on board his nightmare, his waking nightmare is where he needs to go.
Yeah.
He holds on to Daj's necklace for strength.
It's, I think, illustrative of how serious he is about this mission, how much he misses Data, that he's willing to do this. Because, like, this is a man that has not faced this fear, has not dealt with this trauma in the intervening, you know, 27 years or whatever.
I think many episodes of Star Trek Picard give you a half an hour of standard pace, and then we're running downhill for the last 20 minutes. And I think This is the moment where we start running downhill this episode, like so many others.
Indeed.
Because back on the cube, Soji wakes up and she's clearly upset by having not won her game of five-finger filet. She could not stay awake for her mom. And then she starts compulsively digging through her own things. And she's using a scanner and growing more and more frustrated. And I think anyone who's used a scanner for any reason can understand Soji's frustration in using it.
Probable age, 37 months.
Yeah, I would be concerned that maybe there was something 37 months old in the, like, optical feed of the scanner. Like, oh, like, yeah, there's something jammed in there and it thinks everything's 37 months old.
Or maybe like the 37 is upside down and what we're really thinking is it's supposed to be like 73, or maybe it's upside down and backwards, so it should be reading something else entirely.
Yeah, she's pissed.
Using a scanner is like a USB cable. Like, you always put the paper in wrong the first time before having to flip it.
Right. Yeah, and then it's wrong the second time. You're like, fuck. I was right the first time, but it just didn't go.
It's impossible. Yeah.
Hate it. I'm looking at this scene now. She's got the Williams-Sonoma herb gardens in her quarters, too.
I mean, maybe that was a nice gift by Narek, right?
I mean, he has plenty.
Yeah.
You might as well give a couple up. This is a really intense scene. She's really freaking out about it and chucks the scanner at the wall. And then we cut to Picard beaming into the Borg cube. And no welcoming party for the Admiral retired. He's just in this spooky kind of haunted house feeling space. And then he starts to kind of have like a Vietnam flashback kind of thing. Like, and these are very quick cuts, but we get images of like the Borg Queen and him as Locutus and fully fledged members of the collective before we realize that he's being helped on this like guardrail-less walkway.
Yeah.
That, you know, like the building code was not observed when they made this walkway, and he comes close to falling off, and a couple of XBs are catching him and holding him up. And what snaps him out of it is actually Hugh calling out to him. Hugh is really excited to see him.
Hugh greets Picard very warmly, and it feels amazing after seeing what Picard has been through over the last minute. I think this is a show that knows how we feel about this character and the actor to such an extent that when he's subjected to great pain, the way he is in this scene, it's a real stomach punch to see it. And when Hugh greets him warmly, like, Ben, we're in the sixth episode of this season. Finally, someone is happy to see Picard. Like, I don't think it's happened before on an episode.
Yeah, he doesn't say, "What the hell are you doing out here, Picard?"
Right. It's such a pressure release valve when Hugh greets him and they embrace. It's like, finally, like this is good and safe. It's such a great moment. And it's not just for this episode. It's for this season.
Yeah. I guess Zani was pretty happy to see Picard.
Yeah.
But we don't know Zani. We know Hugh.
Right. Right. Hugh, like any good host, gives him the tour, you know. And Picard is doing, like, this is more physical acting from Patrick Stewart. Picard is lowering his head so he's not recognized by other people. And the conversation that Hugh and Picard have during the tour is really heavy stuff. This is stuff we've hypothesized about forever.
When somebody's giving you a tour of their home, you don't go like, oh, God, what the hell? Why would you move in a place like this?
Yeah. But Picard is so traumatized to be there. It's not just
this place is a dump
kind of vibes, like
no water.
It's not like that. It's instead like, how could you live here if you feel the trauma that I feel? And it's a double or tripling down of the conversation that Picard had with Seven of Nine, where they really dig into each other's past and come to some kind of understanding. What we learn about Hugh is that he's not the leader of the Reclamation Project because he's the best at his job. It really seemed like he was the best of what's left, and he didn't have anywhere else to go, almost.
He's got a position of privilege in that he's a citizen of the Federation.
Right.
And he's talking about how, like, the other XBs on the station are subject to Romulan rule, mm-hmm. and that, like, we know that to be quite a bit less egalitarian than
that's big
what the Federation does.
Yeah.
I also really liked that Picard had not heard the term XB before.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's like the main XB, man.
Yeah. He's the OG XB. Hugh has got this place wired almost the way that Narek does. Like, as Picard is explaining the Soji situation to Hugh, Hugh already has had his suspicions about her and has seen all the angles.
Right.
So their knowledge transfer has been expedited in this scene. We don't have to watch the episode again with them for them both to be brought up to speed.
Yeah. Hugh's a pretty sharp cookie.
Yeah.
Speaking of sharp cookies, Narek is now, like, actively suggesting to Soji that she is kind of like a Manchurian android.
Mm-hmm.
All of the objects that she owns are fabricated. And he's like, maybe all of your, you know, memories are fabricated also. They've been implanted and you're here to do something. You don't even know what, like, you're being used and you don't even know what you're being used for. Which is, I imagine, in a moment like this, that would be like the most comforting explanation. Like, okay, like I have like a finger hold on a reality, even though, like, my entire past has been stripped away and made a fiction. Like, this person is offering me a way forward.
Right.
Even though he's been super shady this episode. Like, I feel like this episode does a great job of riding the line between him being like openly shady around her and also like making you understand like what the justification is for her trusting him or like continuing to extend him little bits of trust.
That's a great point. It also makes me think of the Measure of the Man episode because like at any point Data could have left the trial with Bruce Maddox, tore his way through the station, stolen a ship and left. And it feels like Soji's a little bit like that. She doesn't have anyone else to trust. I think she's going along with it because she's as suspicious about herself as Narek might be. Who else is she going to get answers from? If she's got any hope at all of finding them, I mean, she clearly doesn't know what she is at this point and doesn't know that she could tear through everyone and steal a ship and leave, but maybe some of that is inside her, you know, like play the game to get the knowledge. Yeah. And if such a time arises where I've got to kick some ass, then maybe that's there for her, buried in her code.
Her heavy metal Romulan boyfriend suggests maybe meditation is the way out.
Everyone's talking about meditation as a way to fix all your mental problems.
There's a Romulan ritual meditation called Jalmak. And he sings her a little song about it, Adam. He says,
sleep with one eye open, gripping your tangerine kind tight. Exit light, enter Jalmak, take my hand, tell me all your secrets then.
That's great, yeah.
We didn't realize that he had such a beautiful singing voice, you know?
Well, I mean, he was using that karaoke machine that pitch corrects a little bit. Like the karaoke machine with training wheels.
Yeah, I hope Rob doesn't put any filters of that kind on my beautiful singing voice.
No.
Because I nailed it.
Yours is perfect as it is. We go from the promise of that scene and all the emotions contained therein to some very different emotions as Hugh continues his tour. When Picard sees the work that they're doing and you see the pride that Hugh has in it, I couldn't help but get a little emotional watching this. And the way that they're described is like, they're like the Borg have always been victims and not monsters. It's easy to see their horde and think of them as the monsters that they are by virtue of their actions, but they're all slaves to this thing. They're not doing it because they want to.
Yeah.
And that was such an elegant way to put it.
This returning to the scene of trauma and then finding a path to redemption there that you didn't expect is such a nice bit of storytelling. And you really feel like Picard is surprised to be finding this.
I really wonder if there is a moment where they're like, you know who could really get with a scene like this is Seven of Nine?
Yeah.
And I wonder if the reason they didn't do it was so that it could be Picard's centerpiece as a character. Like, make this his story alone.
Yeah. It's called Star Trek Picard. It's not called Star Trek Picard, comma, Seven of Nine.
Right. Yeah. I love this scene. And I love, like, the Borg being given a makeover and they spin his barber's chair around so he could check out his new eye. That was a really nice moment. And that could have been so cheesy in less caring hands, I think. I think they really got the tone of this right. And I think a lot of it might have to do with the music. There's a lot of that that big kettle timpani sound from First Contact. Like when we're on the Borg ship, I think we're hearing that percussion a lot. That we're familiar with from that movie specifically. And I don't think that's an accident. Like we're grounding it in the music too. It's very familiar in that way.
I agree. And I also like that Hugh is a little bit working an angle here.
Mm-hmm.
They go to this room because this is where Hugh expects to find Soji. And instead she's not there and he discovers she's called in sick. But he also like works in like, hey, like if you could be like speaking about this publicly and like advocating for the XBs, like that would be actually pretty awesome because right now, like nobody speaks up for them.
Yeah. And Picard's like, God, I didn't come here to get pitched an idea, Hugh. Like You know, I actually don't give on my front porch. Maybe if you could leave a pamphlet, I can take it with me.
The last time I spoke in public, it went pretty bad. I don't know if you've been following the news.
The public speaking does not go well, Hugh. So Picard's clearly been in touch with Rios, and Rios marches right into Raffi's room to say that she's lost the bet that they made.
You owe me two strips of latinum.
The bet being the other twin of Daj's would be alive. But they both hypothesize why in the world Soji would be alive.
What would benefit the Tal Shiar or the Jat Vash from leaving her alive? Like, they know where she is. They're on to her. Doesn't make sense.
No. No, it doesn't.
They don't know about this whole homeworld thing.
So I think we're going to get an answer to that question here soon, because we cut directly to Narek and Soji outside of the Borg yurt where they're going to do their meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Another doorman.
Yeah, you don't expect to see the guy in the windbreaker with the neck roll outside of a yurt, but he's like, got to bring a couple more girls, man.
Yeah.
Narek is like, haven't I talked to you already?
Steam room is for more than just couples. But Narek talks his way in by pulling rank.
He has something to hold over this guy.
Yeah. And this yoga studio is where they're going to do Jalmak, Ben. This is it.
This is where it's a take my hand off to re-glam.
Yeah, it's just a whole lot of trust falls and cupping. It's great. Yeah,
he's got Reiki, so he's going to do a little bit of that.
Narek does that thing where he pays off a dialogue tease from earlier, because Soji's like, you know, I know you can't tell me your real name, because that's not what Romulans do unless they've met their one true love. And then Narek drops his real name on her in this scene, so to encourage her to participate in this ritual.
I put on the subtitles in this scene. The name that he gives is spelled H-R-A-I-Y-A-N.
Yeah.
But he pronounces it Rayan,
mm-hmm.
which sounds a lot like the French for nothing. Rien.
Whoa.
It sounds like he's saying nothing.
Rayan.
That's good trivia that I obviously wouldn't have gotten.
That name means nothing! I read the subtitles!
Tricking this young girl into meditating in front of you so she reveal her most intimate secret is a war crime.
I can't do the French voice. It's a throat shredder, man. Forget it. That's all I got.
You do great.
So what Narek gets Soji to do is describe the dream from the cold open. And then Rizzo is behind one of those like interrogation mirrors watching the whole thing.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Yeah. She's got the surveillance up. And so what they get to when they've got Soji convinced to push past the fear of being yelled at to get out of Daddy's lab is that on a slab in Dad's lab is the wooden artist doll. But it's Soji. She's all in wooden pieces. And she said, it's me. And I wondered, is it her or is it her sister? Like, how does she know? Why doesn't that come up?
How would she
know?
Why
in all of this, why in all of these times when she's been scared and feeling alone and needing to deal with her feelings, has she not called her sister? Like, as far as we know, she doesn't know that her sister is dead.
Whoa. Pretty good point.
I don't understand that part. Like, I think it's kind of a hole at this point that she hasn't turned to her twin sister.
That is strange.
It's felt weird for like a couple episodes now.
Did you look at this table and you see like the torso and some arms and like in a doll you get the pelvis part, but then there's like this big rolling pin. Like, why is the wooden crank there? What possible purpose could that serve? Maybe Narek's into getting pegged. With an actual wooden peg.
Narek can't get to completion if he's not taking it in the booty.
Right. And so we're going to cross cut between the meditation scene and Picard and Hugh here in pretty rapid succession. Because from here, we go back to Hugh and Picard, and they're at Soji's door. They see the room has been tossed. And something happens in this scene that I wanted to ask you about, which is we hear that on the PA system that chronometric activity has been detected in parts of the ship. We know what that means, Ben.
Yeah.
They're creating a temporal vortex.
Time travel.
When they see the room tossed, though, I think they both start to they suspect that she's in real danger because Hugh tries to look for her and they can't find her. They don't know that she's tossed her own room.
There's some Star Trek continuity here, which is that, like, we know that you can just ask the computer where somebody is in Star Trek and go straight to them. But almost never is that the first choice. You know, it's always like, I went and tried to find them and they weren't there. So then I asked the computer.
Exactly.
And so that's when they ask the computer and they find that Soji is not listed as being on the station. And graniton particles, I think, can also have to do with cloaking. So maybe there's a cloaking field around the yoga studio.
The yurt blocks the sensors.
Yeah.
So back in the meditation scene, Soji pushes past the limit of her dream. The previous limit was when she got into the lab and she couldn't quite see past the flowers. She pushes past that. She pushes past it and sees, like so many awful dreams, like how faces are obscured and distorted, ring-like even. It's scary because her father turns around, gets super mad at her, and we're hearing Narek, like, press her forward, like, encouraging her to keep going, to describe what she's seeing. And she's, like, looking out the skylight, and she's seeing these two red moons and a bunch of lightning. And when we cut back to Rizzo, she's like, gotcha, sucker. Like that's enough information to locate the homeworld that they've been looking for the whole time.
It's more like dream logic, right? Because, like, when you look out the skylight of a house that has rain dumping on it, and you can clearly see moons in the sky.
That's a great point. Yeah.
But it seems like actionable enough for Rizzo, and seems like Narek has really redeemed himself.
Yeah, but Narek has also done that thing where he finally got the conquest of the girl in his sights, and after having gotten what he wanted, he tries to freeze her out.
Or Star Trek nemesis her out by opening his little rhombics cube, which has some pink puffs inside of it. Very, very reminiscent of the Romulan Senate scene at the beginning of Nemesis, except for Soji is not going to take this lying down the way those senators and Romulan commanders did. She starts beating the shit out of the floor of the studio until she's punched a hole through it, like a huge hole.
It's great. Do you feel like this is activation, or is this her feeling herself? Maybe not an insightful synthetic, but what else can she do but pound the ground? And then she realizes the strength and then goes through.
I think she's activated because, like, later she can, like, she has, like, heightened hearing and stuff.
All right. Like, I guess the scene that makes me question whether or not she's been activated is that when she meets Picard and Hugh, after having jumped through that hole, she doesn't, like, tear all of their heads off and and, like, go totally Wolverine.
Oh, interesting. I was kind of surprised in the other way, because Daj, like, when she closed her eyes, would picture Picard. Like, Picard was the only person she felt safe around.
Okay.
And I thought like they had to pick something, right? Like, how much is she going to, like, automatically trust Picard? And I was a little bit surprised at how reticent she was at first.
Yeah.
I love when Hugh and Picard are running to find Soji, and, like, somebody recognizes Locutus, like, yo, Locutus, I haven't seen you in years. What's going on, man?
That moment raised so many questions for me, because if that guy recognized Locutus, wouldn't everyone recognize him because of the shared collective knowledge?
Yeah.
That struck me as strange that person was the only one to do that.
Well, different people act differently around celebrities, you know?
Yeah.
Some people go up and interrupt their dinner, and others are like, oh, yeah, like, it's cool that we saw that person.
If you were an XB, Ben, you would have sat down right next to Picard and you wouldn't have said anything.
Yeah. I would have been 2 inches from Picard for a 45-minute airplane flight, and I wouldn't have spoken up.
It's a foot race here, and Picard and Hugh beat the horde of Romulans that are chasing Soji down. When they finally meet up, Picard is able to get through to her and gain her trust.
Yeah, he has to do it really quickly, but he's able to do it. And I think that probably Hugh being with Picard helps.
Yeah, I think it definitely does.
Hugh knows about something that's going on in the queen cell, which Picard immediately recognizes. The Borgs apparently assimilated the Sicarians, which are a group of aliens from an episode of Voyager. There's an episode of Voyager where they like run into some aliens that have technology that could, I think it's like not quite enough to get them home, but it's like, it's enough to like cut their trip in half or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a reverse Prime Directive episode where they're like, hey, can we use this technology to like get home? And they're like, oh no, like we actually have rules against that. And, I remember it as being like a really good episode of Voyager, and I liked the reference here.
I have not seen much of Voyager at all and did not get the reference. When I heard Sicarian, I was thinking of Iconian and the Iconian gateway TNG. And so I was like, yeah, man, like walk through that gate, go straight to Canada. That's what you should be doing. You'll be safe there.
Yeah. Just wait till it cycles to Paris and then... walk on through.
Pretty great. And so much story here in so little time in this queen cell, Ben. I love it. I love how Hugh is like taking down and putting up these wild walls in the Borg cube. It's totally reconfigurable to him.
Yeah.
Caught up in the action of this scene is Elnor, who has disappeared from the La Serena and has beamed over to the artifact.
And Picard has been saying like, hey, like we're going to get out of here by other means, but meet up with us. And that's going to be a planet. They give the name of the planet as Nepenthe.
Right.
Which I wonder if it's in the same system as Rurapenthe.
Yeah. There are even fewer stockades on Nepenthe.
They haven't even heard of electronic frontiers on Nepenthe. But Elnor is there on the cube with them. He's somehow transported himself and he quickly dispatches three ROMs that were way ahead of the rest of the horde that is bearing down on them.
You know what I love about what we're learning about Elnor is that all he knows how to do is kill someone in a disgusting dismemberment fashion. And I'm so glad it's him because it's such a great counterpoint to his innocence, right? Like he is...
yeah.
He's like Big, right? He's Tom Hanks and Big, except he's the killing machine version of that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like if Tom Hanks and Big had like 80 bodies.
Yeah, that's what it is. And I love that counterpoint in him. I think it would be dark and gross if Elnor was a serious adult man with serious ideas and had that sort of like darkness tinge to him.
If he was like world weary the way Rios is.
Yeah, but because Elnor is Tom Hanks from Big, like the gore goes down a little easier to me, I think.
Picard can't convince Elnor to come with them because Elnor wants to defend their retreat. So he and Hugh stay behind while Picard and Soji go through the gate.
I was sad about this. I wanted everyone to go.
Yeah, why didn't Hugh just go with them?
Yeah, I wanted Hugh to go.
But Hugh probably feels responsible for all the XBs there. He's trying to get them freed.
Yeah, that's real needs of the many outweigh the needs of the couple of guys, including Picard.
They shut down the gate and then hide the room back up. And we end on black and just hear Elnor urging some Romulans to choose to live.
Pretty great ending. I love how they're doing a lot of that L edit type stuff, right? We're getting dialogue hanging over the end of scenes, and this is one of them.
Did you like the episode, Adam?
I think this was my favorite of the season so far, really.
Wow.
I really loved it a lot, and I think it was for those scenes with Picard and Hugh. I was really, really affected by them in a profound way. I didn't know how much I wanted to hear those things from those characters. That shared experience they have was really profound. And I mean, like we were saying before, it should have been interrogated so much more in TNG than we ever got. So it's just really great to experience that now that we have the chance again. What about you?
Yeah, I really liked it too. I have to confess, I watched it the first time, like, usually my process for the show is I'll watch it once without my notebook and then watch it again with my notebook. And I feel like I enjoyed it more the second time I watched it. Like if for some reason, like didn't quite click for me the first time. But yeah, I really liked it. I thought it was a strong and interesting app.
Yeah, I wonder if we have any strong and interesting Priority One messages, though.
Oh, I bet we do.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Adam, we have a couple of P1s here. The first one is of a personal nature. It's from Joey. It's to all LGBT Trek fans everywhere. Goes like this. Liking Star Trek is gay culture, but we're happy to share it with Ben, Adam, and the Friends of DeSoto.
That's very generous.
Anyway, here's the Chris Brenner drop.
I'm Chris Brenner. Brenner Information Systems. You know, interface, operations, net access, channel 90.
That Chris Brenner.
Excellent job. Look at you putting the quarters into the drop machine. Nice.
Yeah. I like the cut of Joey's jib.
Me too.
Thank you for sharing this part of gay culture with us.
Yeah, I'm glad we didn't have to ask permission.
Yeah.
Or forgiveness.
We may have inadvertently done cultural appropriation, but I'm glad that we're in the clear.
Yeah.
At least from Joey's perspective.
Ben, our second Priority One message is from Alex. It is to you and me. The message goes like this. Discovery and you two got me back into Star Trek. I was a TOS kid who never took to TNG, but now I'm working through DS9 with you and loving all Shimoda properties. Thanks so much.
Cool.
Can I suggest you check out Dagger of the Mind for bonus content? It was the first ep that caught the interest of a kid who was too lazy to change the channel.
Huh.
Dagger of the Mind.
TOS episode, I presume?
That's a first season TOS episode. So, yeah, we should look into that. Good rec. Often in the Greatest Discovery off-season, we'll dip back into TOS eps, but it's hard to predict what the show will become as more new Star Trek episodes come down the pipe.
Yeah.
Well, something very useful that comes down the pipe weekly are the Priority One messages, and they are what sustain the show financially. You can get one of your own by going over to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron, where personal messages are $100 and commercial messages are $200. And as I said, they are the only way that the show gets made. If we're not going to sell any ads on it.
They are far from being the only way, because we also have generous monthly support from the people who go to MaximumFun.org/join.
That's true. Rob, take all that out. I'm wrong. I'm dead wrong. But all of it. I'm grateful.
Leave it
for
in, Rob. I want this on the record. Adam was wrong.
I'm grateful for all the support, obviously. Can't do it without it. Thank you.
Squarespace. Got to build yourself a website if you want to stand out online. Social media websites are not cutting it anymore, and you really can't tell the story of what you do and sell your products or services or time effectively without a really great looking website. Squarespace is the way to do it. Using Squarespace Blueprint, you can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options. You make a seamless checkout option for your customers. You can accept PayPal, Apple Pay, and in eligible countries offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Amazing. So head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/trek to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
It's Webby season. Hi, I'm Sequoia Holmes, host of the Black People Love Paramore podcast. And we are nominated for a Webby for the episode where I interviewed Hayley Williams. In case you're unfamiliar, Black People Love Paramore is a podcast delving into the common and uncommon interests of Black people in order to help us feel more seen. We would love your vote to help us win this Webby. Please take a second, go over to the Black People Love Paramore podcast social media accounts, and you can find them at BPLP Pod across all social media platforms. Hit the link in bio and vote for Black People Love Paramore.
Hi, I'm Travis McElroy.
And I'm Teresa McElroy.
And we're the host of Schmanners.
We don't believe that etiquette should be used to judge other people.
No, on Schmanners, we see etiquette as a way to navigate social situations with confidence.
So if that sounds like something you're into,
join us every Friday on Maximum Fun, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself an Edward Larkin?
Edward Larkin! I did. I don't want to be accused of biting a rhyme here, but my Edward Larkin is Rios.
All right.
In this episode. And it's because he finishes a workout. He's obviously, like, winded at the end of his soccer ball workout. And he goes for a flask. He doesn't get water first?
Oh, no.
He starts hitting the sauce immediately after a workout?
It seems like a very unsatisfying post-workout beverage, like the cookie dough Gatorade of SNL. Also, like, wouldn't you get an instant headache if you hit booze after a workout?
Yeah. I just don't understand him. I don't understand how he could be, like, 10 times more shredded than I am and also drink as problematically as he does. And he's not even the most problematic drinker on the show.
No, he sure isn't. Not by a long shot. Wow.
Adam, did you have an Edward Larkin?
Yeah, I'm going to give it to Elnor. I think for reasons stated, like the, to borrow a drop from the hit podcast Friendly Fire, he is a hell of a combination of extreme violence and extreme innocence, and all of his in butts and out butts. And how he totally copped Girardi and Rios having been freshly fucked. He's so capable and so innocent at the same time. He's just an incredible character that I'm getting to be a really big fan of. So, I mean, I'm a Rios man through and through. Uh-huh. Have been the entire season, but I'm gonna give this one this time to Elnor.
Okay, I'm glad I didn't step on your territory this time.
No way.
We saw a little promo for the next episode. It looks like Hugh gets in fairly serious trouble with Rizzo, and it looks like this is going to be the episode where Picard meets up with Troy and Riker.
What are the chances that Riker and Troy have chosen to live on Nepenthe in their retirement? Is that what's happening, or did Picard and Soji go to Nepenthe and then go to Lake Armstrong or something?
I mean, if that is Nepenthe, Nepenthe looks an awful lot like the heaven that Kirk builds for himself in Star Trek Generations.
Yeah.
Crazy band of energy in space.
I mean, he's retired well. If that's his version of heaven, good for him.
Picard is like, I keep meeting people in houses like this and asking them to come help me beat up old men.
My particular kink is being called a dillweed by other captains. Wow, well, that sounds great. I couldn't be more excited to meet up with Riker again. Are you just going to mute all the scenes with him? Keep a safe distance from everything Frakes related?
No, if it's mediated by television, I'm perfectly happy to see what Frakes has to say.
All right, that's good. That's really good. It would be hard to do the show any other way.
Well, that will be next week, and we'll leave it with Robs from here.
Hard to do the show without Robs.
The Greatest Discovery is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted by Adam Pranica and Ben Harrison. The show is produced and edited by me, Rob Schulte. Our theme music is produced by Friend of DeSoto and YouTube sensation Adam Ragusea. The Greatest Discovery is a podcast that's made possible by the support of listeners like you. To make sure that we continue to make episodes, visit MaximumFun.org/join and pledge your support. By doing so, you'll gain access to all of the Maximum Fun bonus content, including our bonus episodes. If you want to chat about the show on various forms of social media, just search for our discussion groups or use the hashtag #GreatestDiscovery. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenjaminAHR. Adam's found at Cut for Time, and I'm at Rob K. Schulte. Thanks.
Hey, hold on a second. I gotta talk to John.
Okay.
You really want to make the show.
Yeah. I want to be on this show so I can add a little bit of critical thinking to it.
Yeah.
You guys are fanboys. And
yeah.
Anyway, I'm going to open the garage door. It's going to be loud.
Mm-hmm.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.